Welcome to Homeground. I'm Brian Kahn. In our recent program on conservation of wolverines, the subject of hunting came up, whether hunters can feel real affection for their quarry. That exchange generated a sharp email from a listener who criticized what she feels is my pro-hunting bias. A vegan, she feels hunting other than for necessary food is morally wrong, ecologically damaging, and generally full of he-man hype. She's a professor of philosophy at MSU Billings and also a widely published author. Professor Lisa Kemmerer, many thanks for joining us on Homeground. Where were you born? What did your folks do?
I was born out in a very rural place on the West Coast, out on the water, in a place called Conway. My dad was a high school teacher, and my mom was a music teacher, but she stayed home with us and taught music at home. We had horses and chickens, and we wrung their necks, and we raised our own hay and had a big garden, and mom preserved all the food, and we lived very much on the land. My dad grew up on the land.
So it was a serious farming background you have.
Absolutely, but it wasn't a money-making farm, and my dad made that decision because he grew up on a dairy farm, and he knew how difficult that was, and also he just wanted to teach.
Where did you go to school? What did you study?
I was a very difficult student. I didn't like studying and I didn't like books. I liked to be outside and do outside things. So I kept dropping out of school and running away. So I went to a lot of different schools and it took me a very long time to get through school. So I first just went to Central Washington University because my sister was there and I just wanted to be with my sister. And after a year, I was just so miserable. I went overseas and I'd work for a summer as a forest firefighter and then I'd travel. Go overseas and travel with my backpack for as long as my money lasted. So I did that. And so I went to then a community college and got an AA degree and then was hanging out in the woods working for the Department of Natural Resources. And someone came along and said, you need to go to Reed College. So I did. And I finished up there and traveled more. And
what did you study at Reed?
International studies, probably affected by my travels and all I was learning. And then I went to Harvard Divinity School, and then I went to...
Harvard Divinity School?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, why the Divinity? Where's that from in your family? I assume that means serious religious study.
Yes, and it came also a lot from my traveling. Everywhere I went, I could see that religions were fighting with each other. There was just so much anger and violence, and I knew that the core of every religion has nothing to do with what I was seeing. So it inspired me, and I thought, I can bring a change here. So that's why I went to study at a divinity school.
Well, how'd you get into philosophy?
Well, then I figured out it would be good if I could actually have a job and I could probably maybe balance the things. So I did religion and philosophy. And of course, my dad all along said, don't study philosophy, you'll never get a job. But, you know, he's a dad looking out for me and I knew my heart. So I did what was in my heart.
When you look at yourself when you left for college, what were your central values?
That's a huge question. My values have always been kindness. A kindness, I guess, would be maybe at the core, a compassion and a caring. And living close to people, not the distance and the hurriedness and the... I think our culture, it moves around a lot and we don't make connection. And I think connection is very important. And the earth. I love the environment. I love the earth that we live on.
How would you compare that person at that age, say 18, with the young woman that graduates with a philosophy degree and your joint degree? Any changes? What did you learn that you didn't know in the academic world?
The core is the same. When I was at Divinity School in Boston, I had a third year I could have had for free at Harvard. It would have been a dream, but I felt like my soul was turning into a little piece of black coal in Boston. It was just a very cold place to be. So I graduated and left, and it had less to do with the ideas. I was loving what I was learning. But that environment on the East Coast just was not, it didn't work for me.
In our correspondence, you defined yourself as a vegan and expressed the view that that movement or practice does not get any sort of play on the airways, including public radio, and you felt it reflected a bias. So let's start with your philosophy. Define it for us, please.
It's so true what you say, and I'm very frustrated with NPR because I listen to it all the time. And whereas they understand most of the connections of, I don't know if you want to call it PC, but it's, the animal issue isn't one that they touch
PC.
On. PC, politically correct. The idea that you don't want to be racist, sexist, homophobic. But when it comes to animals, they seem to have no sensitivity that they are also individual living beings that we should take account of. And I guess you ask for my philosophy. Again, that's a huge question. Compassion is at the core. So when I make choices, I try to make choices that do the least possible harm. And not just to animals, but to other human beings, to the earth itself. And so in my work, I bumbled my way through philosophy. So I started out just with the idea of compassion and trying to live gently on the earth. And then this led me to notice, actually through others who pointed out to me, you know, there's a link between sexism and speciesism. Speciesism being like racism, treating animals in ways we would never want to be treated ourselves when there's no morally relevant distinction. So, for example, people can suffer and other animals can suffer. And so where suffering is concerned, we absolutely have to take them into consideration. So speciesism, like racism, is treating an individual different, but you can't reason why you would treat them differently.
Let me see if I heard you right. Compassion is at the center of your philosophy. Animals deserve compassion in the same way that human beings under most religions deserve compassion. They're individuals, they're sentient creatures, and so that unnecessary suffering inflicted on animals becomes a moral wrong in your eyes.
You said that wonderfully. You heard me very well.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We are talking with Professor of Philosophy Lisa Kemmerer, who teaches at MSU Billings and is a vegan. You won't be surprised when I say I have some questions. In your view, your philosophy, is man, humankind, part of the natural world or distinct?
Both. Both, and I think this is one of the things that our culture does. We have a tendency to put dualistic opposites out there and put those as the only options. And I think because of my travels in the East, I have very much of a sense of and with, that it can be both. So human beings are definitely part of the natural world. We're animals, we're mammals, we're primates. Especially because I am a human, I notice that I feel that I'm different. I'm not my dog, and I'm not a cat, and I'm not a chicken or a turkey. And so in many ways, we're similar. And in some ways, we're also very distinct as a species, as every species is.
Does that distinction elevate us, in your mind, in any respect above other species for example, utilitarian use of other species, something you criticize? Is human life more important than the life of a cow, for example, or your dog, your beloved dog, if you have the same attitude toward dogs as I do?
I do. I definitely do. And I have three dogs who I love dearly. Again, this is a very Western view, this idea of a hierarchy. And I couldn't say that I view the world. I don't view the world in a hierarchy.
In your book, which I have read two-thirds of it, the chapter on commercial fishing wasn't able to read before the show, you make a distinction between animals and plants. You are willing to kill and eat plants, but you are not willing to kill or eat animals or animal byproducts like milk or eggs.
Yes.
So clearly there seems to be a hierarchy between animals and plants in your worldview about what's morally acceptable to eat.
No, it's not a hierarchy. I just acknowledge the differences between them. So I have to eat to live. I have to kill something to eat. And it's better to kill something that can't suffer, that, say, for example, doesn't have a sense of family or community, because when you kill a member of a community or kill somebody who's sentient, it's a more serious killing than when you kill, for instance, a plant that can't suffer and doesn't have a sense of those around, and those around aren't harmed when that plant disappears.
I do a lot of reading. I can't remember where I read that plants or trees, I can't remember, react in a measurable way when either other plants are being chopped down or trees are being cut. Okay, so there is a response. Mm-hmm. I assume in 50 years we'll know more about the response than we know here. Mm-hmm. Having been around livestock and the slaughter of livestock, I have seen the response of the animals to that process, and they know what's going on. I don't think clams or snails have as developed a response. In your philosophy, is it more legitimate if we're making distinctions to eat clams and snails than it is beef?
My goodness. By my understanding of what I want to do, I want to eat with as least suffering as possible. So what I have to be careful of is my ability to understand. Can I understand a snail or a clam? I don't know. You're right, I can absolutely see the suffering in a cow, and for that reason, I don't ever want to exploit or harm them unless I absolutely have to. So yes, I think that maybe you'd want to eat a snail before a cow, but that might be based on my bias as a land mammal who maybe doesn't understand a snail or a clam.
But you don't eat clams or snails.
No, uh-uh.
You draw the line at vegetables. Correct?
I wouldn't say I draw a line. I just eat as low as I can. If you presented me with, I have to eat something to live, and that entails, it doesn't have to entail killing. For example, you can eat seeds and nuts, but that's not something I do. I recognize it would be a better thing if I did that. I wouldn't kill anything. But for me personally, if I'm not causing suffering, that's where my ethics carry me.
Okay, but this is not just personal. It's not your own ethics. You've written several books. The book that I read is pretty hot.
Yes.
Okay, in other words, we'll discuss some of the things you say about voluntary, discretionary meat eating and hunters in particular. So you not only have personal passion, you want to share that passion and convert people to your point of view.
Convert is a religious term. I want people to understand the ideas so that they can make a choice. Let me explain. There's five main reasons why I am a vegan. Is first, because the animals suffer. Second, because health. We hurt ourselves and we hurt others when our health isn't good, and we drive up medical cost when we eat things that harm us. And there's definitely links between the five biggest harms to our health and eating of animal products. This third one is oppressions. So, and the one that's most important here is that there's so many hungry people in the world. And when we cycle grains through other animals, we're saying, oh, well, you don't have anything to eat, but I'm going to feed this into a cow or a chicken or a pig, and then I'm going to eat them. And even though it's a huge loss of food value, that's what I want to do, and I have the power to do it, and I'm going to do it. And I don't want to do that. The third one is religions, that all religions teach compassion. And there's no question that it's more compassionate to eat some corn than it is to eat the cow. And the third one is the earth, that there is huge environmental impact when you raise so many grains and feed them to other animals, and the animals themselves have an environmental impact. So for all of those reasons, I choose not to eat animal products.
Okay, appreciate that very clear explanation. But I have to say, I don't quite understand the distinction, having read your book. It's an advocacy book. You are trying to convince people that you are right. You're frustrated that you don't get airtime. You wouldn't need airtime unless you were trying to convince people. And there's nothing wrong with that as far as I'm concerned at all. You want to express your view and convince people to change their behavior. Is that not fair?
That isn't how I see it. I want to put the information out there, and then people can decide. But if they don't have the information, they can't decide.
You hope they'll decide to support what you do.
I think that the information is powerful.
You're listening to Homeground, and I am Brian Kahn. We are talking with Professor Lisa Kemmerer of Montana State University at Billings about her writing and philosophy and her veganism. Let's talk about food production. Pesticides and herbicides are widely used. You have some data in your book. When Rachel Carson wrote Silent Spring about 60 years ago, I think we're 50 times as much herbicides and pesticides that don't hold me to that number are used. Billions of insects are killed by the use of those chemicals, and monocultures are created which do not support habitat for wild species. One might argue that taking wild animals for meat that are living naturally on the land in limited quantities is a much less ecologically damaging way of getting food than having these vast monocultures that your diet requires. What would you say to that?
I'd say that there are certainly some arguments that one could make in that direction, but when you look more closely, it's just a different set of problems that arise. And again, I would recall back to the idea that at the end of the day, eating with less suffering doesn't point to eating other animals. It points to eating plants. But the problems that arise specifically when you switch from cows to deer is that we manipulate ecosystems on behalf of hunters. Fish and Game earns money through the licenses, and then they do things like trapping carnivores, which of course affects ecosystems. So if you really want the natural world to be natural, hunting works against that.
My specific question was the creation of vast monocultures. You gave some data, something like one-third of the earth, is in arable lands. You're talking about converting wildlife habitat into sterile monocultures to feed people vegetables and livestock. You point out most of the feed, soy and corn, is fed to livestock, and it's terribly inefficient, and you feel it's unethical. And I think you can make a pretty strong case there. But what you don't mention at all is that the vegetarian diet creates wasteland for habitat and kills billions of insects and their life form that you claim to have concern for. Is that a fair criticism of your book?
Well, it's as I say, no matter what you eat, there will be killing, and it's a matter of minimizing. And again, remember that when you raise cattle and pigs and chickens, that's when you have the monocultures. So if you don't eat the animals, you will need 70% of our grains in the United States are fed to farmed animals. So if we stopped eating the farmed animals, we wouldn't need 70% of what we're raising, and we wouldn't need the monocultures in particular.
One of the things that surprised me in your book, when you go right at some length on the animal issue, the domestic livestock issue and the greenhouse gases, etc., is you give one paragraph in your book to sustainable local and organic agriculture. That surprised me greatly, because I'm just looking at the organic side or the sustainable side, let's say, and you don't mention at all holistic range management as a way of running livestock in a manner that maintains biodiversity, avoids soil erosion, maintains good water quality. Why that balance? Why that very, very short discussion? Put it, say, as short as charitable.
Well, the reason I don't spend a lot of time on that is because very little of that is done. So the majority of the food we're eating doesn't come from that system.
True.
And the second reason is because ultimately, if you do care about these ideas, then you'll recognize that no matter how you're raising the chicken or the cow, they're still going to harm the environment in important ways. They're still eating the grain. So you're still going to need, chickens are going to still eat the grain. You can still put them out. I saw you react to that in a sense of, I'm wrong, but you're still going to have all the problems of the manure, which get into the water. You're going to have the problems of needing to feed them, needing to keep them, needing to use land for them. So environmentally, the only thing you can really choose is away from animals if you want to bring about the least environmental footprint. And one more thing I want to add is that these different ways, like free range, the grass-fed
beef,
there's very much an elitist element to that, because you're going to need so much land, and it's going to drive up the cost, and only people with considerable money are going to be able to buy these specialized products. Whereas now, we work very hard to keep the cost down, and almost anyone can buy animal products.
That's a very interesting summary that might be given by a person who's in the cattle feeding business. I ran grass-fed beef for about 6 years, have considerable experience with it, and I think the characterization, we don't have time to go into it, but I would fundamentally disagree. I would argue that grass-fed beef, which has become more and more popular, combined with holistic range management, in which I have a certificate in, I'm not a practitioner, dramatically, fundamentally alter the animal's impact on the land, and to hear it called elitist is, to me, not a well-thought-through response. I would just make that comment.
Do you think that it will cost more if we're eating grass-fed beef, and do you think that everyone will be able to eat grass-fed beef? In other words, can you have enough land for enough beef for everyone to make that choice?
No.
Exactly.
I don't think that's the only test of whether everybody can eat everything.
And one more thing I would add with this is that remember that the methane problem is actually worse when they're eating grass because of the work of processing the food.
I've done some reading on methane, and that would be another interesting show, and what's trying to be done with livestock generally to control the serious methane problem. You write about our ecological footprint of our diet. When I graduated from high school 50 years ago, there were 3.3 billion people on the planet. Now there are 7.3 billion. Wouldn't you argue, since we're not a special species fundamentally, that there just ought to be a heck of a lot fewer people on the planet? Wouldn't that make sense to you?
Yes, of course, there should be fewer people, but what I can't control that. What I can control is what I eat.
But you also advocate for a specific diet. You could choose to advocate it for fewer people, which is the primary driver of all these impacts, negative impacts that you articulate so well in your book.
In our part of the world, consumption is the problem. And we kind of point fingers when we look at population because other people have a higher birth rate. But our consumption is equally damaging.
Let me ask you about your three pets. What do you feed them?
They eat vegan dog food.
And what about cats? Is there a lot of vegan cat food?
I don't have any cats, and it is much harder to feed them vegan.
So how do you feel about people who have cats?
Bless their hearts. They're looking after beings that need homes. And it's a really tricky thing because, yeah, they are eating other animals and they kill birds and it's just, but they also are living beings and have to kill to eat. These are tough situations.
You just commented that cats kill birds. Predators kill other animals to eat. And you point out that's the way they're built. They have no choice. But there's a tone, I think, in your book, and correct me if I'm mistaken, that it's almost regrettable that they're not all vegetarians out there, that the herbivores just can't live happily ever after. Is that a misreading, or do you have qualms about cats killing birds?
Well, I think it comes to the fact that compassion is at the heart of who I am and what I do, and that whenever you have a carnivore, they have absolutely no choice but to kill to eat other animals. And of course, that causes suffering, and of course anything that is eaten would prefer not to be eaten. So,
does it bother you, that part of the natural world, that central part of the natural world?
I wouldn't use the word bother me, but it, of course I am sad for things that die that didn't want to die, but it's a reality of how nature works.
One might say it is the fundamental reality about how living nature works. In other words, animals eat other animals or eat plants, and they live and they die. And that one might argue, Homo sapiens and some other animals react to death in an emotional way.
Yes, and that's why it's always something to take seriously.
You spend a third of the book approximately on the subject of hunting. You're not a fan. Your chapter is called Hunting Hype. And one of the things I think you try to argue is that the argument that hunting is connected with conservation is a gross distortion.
Yes.
If we can agree that 7 billion human people have had a negative impact in multiple ways on aquatic and terrestrial habitats, why is it in your book that you don't mention, for example, you live in the state of Montana, Habitat Montana, which is paid for 80% by non-resident hunters who have to pay a higher fee, has conserved 345,000 acres of diverse wildlife and riparian habitats. The Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, which is a hunting-based organization of 220,000 members, says they've protected and enhanced more than 6.8 million acres of habitat. And Ducks Unlimited, which began in the Depression and is basically a waterfowl hunting grassroots organization, has conserved over 13 million acres of wetlands and has long-term conservation agreements on another 270 some million acres, wetlands being among the most rich habitats for something like 900 species. Now, you may not like hunting, and that's clear, but why does your book not acknowledge those unarguable contributions of major proportions by hunters to conserving wildlife habitat?
I think that the book does cover those, but not specifically. You're right, I don't go into the specifics, but I talk about how hunters claim to have done much preservation for the world, conservation for the world. And I think that would be my main point. There's a difference between conservation and preservation. And hunters do conservation. They're conserving specific things for human interests. So they're not preserving the natural world in and of itself. They're conserving the resources that they want to use. And that's a very specific way of looking at our natural world.
If you save a wetland, are you saying that it makes a difference to the species on the wetland, the 900 species that the people who save the wetland want to hunt ducks? Does it change the nature of the wetland in terms of the ecological balance on the planet?
Yes, because they're still doing things like trapping out carnivores in order to protect the target species.
On wetlands?
And that's problematic. They will, as far as I know, they will target carnivores on any lands.
My sense is the chapter on hunting hype criticizes the morality of hunting, not the ecological impact fundamentally, other than the predator argument. It's very critical of the fact that hunters enjoy hunting. Have you ever hunted or have you ever gone hunting with anyone?
I have shot guns and I have killed animals, but I wouldn't say that I've been a hunter.
I found some of your arguments provocative, some of them convincing. The one that I did not find convincing was your assertion that, quote, it is widely documented.
I can see why this would be very offensive to some. What you have to remember is that there is a documented link between killing animals and killing people. And that isn't just me, that's documented. So, for example, serial killers will start by killing animals. And the kids that did the school shootings were all kids who had been trained to hunt and learned to use guns. But I think the most important thing for me is to just put it at face value. If you are killing and you don't need to kill, then you're killing for fun. I mean, yes, you may eat it, but do we want to be the sort of people who kill for fun?
It's a very interesting assumption to say that people hunt for fun. As a serious hunter, I would take it as a pejorative. I don't hunt for fun, but I don't have time to explain why I hunt. But let me just read you something from Backcountry Hunter, from a woman who was on their board of directors. She killed a doe. She broke down in tears. Blinking back tears, I finished field dressing the doe. Then, at home, we skinned the deer, then later cut and wrapped the meat. She fed us both that winter. I knew I would continue to hunt because for me it's the right thing to do. Hunting has reminded me that our actions have consequences that can change us forever. The memory of taking another mother's life demands that I live and hunt with great reverence. I will take that lesson with me to the end of my days.
That's a powerful bit of writing, and she obviously had a very meaningful experience. And meaningful experiences are a very important thing. But I think what we have to ask is, if your meaningful experience causes my death, then you maybe want to rethink your meaningful experience. So in as much as hunting it can be a wonderfully meaningful experience, but it still causes death and damages ecosystems. So the world is filled with possibilities. Why not find another meaningful experience?
Professor Lisa Kemmerer, I very much regret to say we're out of time. I think we could go on for a half hour easily on hunting. Maybe we'll do it in the future. Thank you very much for being with us on Home Ground. To our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week.
Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studios. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.